Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 6:52 p.m. That is on Friday, December 16th, and it is Pacific Standard Time. Well, I would like to apologize first off for the lateness of the recording. Mrs. Tracy popped a disc in her back over a couple of days ago, and it has been rather hectic in the Tracy household since then. So I do apologize for the late recording of the audio, but this being the big picture long-term audio, I thought that I would start off with just addressing, you know, that we are right now in December 16th. There really isn't that much left in the year, and to perhaps look at what have been the best performing markets so far. And starting off with the World Equity Indices page on Bloomberg, we can see very clearly that the Bovespa in Brazil is up 57% in US dollar terms and up 34% in nominal terms. And that is a testament to just how strong the real has been, particularly in the first part of the year. It has given up some of that very strong performance in the last while, not least because the dollar has been so firm. At the other end of the scale, the Chinese market is down 10%, but is down even more in dollar terms, and that is because the renminbi has been going down. But of course, that's not a new phenomenon. It's been going down for 3 years already. And today, or perhaps not so much today, but yesterday, there was news that Japan has now overtaken China as the largest holder of US treasuries. Part of the reason for that is not so much that Japan is suddenly buying lots more treasuries, but rather that China is allowing its reserves to dissipate as it tries to arrest the decline of the renminbi. And that is something that is something that really we will be talking about, I think, for quite some time, because the US Treasury market is looking increasingly like that the low in yields was last July. It was a failed downside break in terms of the yields, and it really is worth taking a look at that. Treasury yields have been compressing for 35 years, and now what we have seen over, really it is since July, but most particularly since the Trump victory in the US presidential election, that the progression of lower rally highs evident since early 2014 has been broken. And when we look at that over the longer term, well, we can't really yet say that this downtrend has been broken. We can certainly observe that there has been a distinct loss of momentum in terms of the momentum of this downtrend, particularly since 2012, that the downside break in July was not sustained, and that it is likely that we are at least going to go up to the 250 area. We're certainly at that right now. I should really update this chart. It's only to last week. We're at 259 on the open today, it closed pretty close to that. But perhaps the progression of lower rally highs is most correctly to be around 3%, and this hasn't been a particularly consistent decline overall. That there have been really quite lengthy periods when we've had rising yields, but it is that these major rally highs have been lower on a consistent basis. And because it is so volatile, and because it has had these very large swings overall, then, and because it has been so very long in the tooth, then what we can also conclude, and I think with reasonable confidence, is that this is a bull market that is not simply going to end with a whimper. It is likely to end with a bang. And it is going to end with a war between supply and demand. The total return on the Merrill Lynch total return on Treasury futures has now experienced its largest pullback ever. And I think that is something that we really should ruminate on. This is not a normal pullback in bonds. This is something that we haven't seen in a very long time indeed. And this is an index that has been going up on a consistent basis since 1983. And this is its largest pullback, and I'm showing it on the logarithmic scale. And even on a logarithmic scale, we can see that something has changed, that the pace of the advance overall has certainly slowed down, that this is a somewhat larger reaction, that we have certainly seen a bigger pullback. And this is characteristic of a type 2 top, where you're getting a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. It is oversold in the short term. We will have absolute confirmation that a top is in when we have evidence that support has been, excuse me, that resistance has been encountered in the region of the 200-day moving average, that then a lower low is encountered. And that might not be for a while. Considering that it was the US presidential election was the catalyst, that there is a lot of bad news for bonds being priced in, and by the same token, there has been a lot of very good news priced in the banking index, and this is the KRX Regional Banks Index, and it has exploded higher. And it isn't just US banks that have exploded higher, it is banks almost everywhere have exploded higher. This dogma that has been espoused, particularly by very noted economists over the last few years, of a new normal, of lower for longer, of a discount rate that could never go higher, and a belief that the status quo that allowed huge amounts of money to be borrowed, massive leverage to be taken on, and to throw caution to the wind because interest rates would be low forever, that is now being rapidly unwound. The very real prospect of fiscal stimulus in the US is what is driving that on. We went through a period of synchronized global economic expansion back in the early 2000s and through to really the, I think probably more correctly, from about 2003 to 2007. That was predicated on the commodity boom and increasing demand just about everywhere. Well, that then transitioned into global monetary expansion, where central banks engaged in massive quantitative easing. What, of course, that contributed to was a massive run-up in asset prices overall. So stocks went up, property went up, and bonds went up, and with the result that yields contracted, that the discount rate went to zero, and therefore spreads relative to it contracted to absolutely to levels that haven't been seen previously in absolute terms. But it did not create the kind of boost to living standards, the boost to employment, and the boost to consumption that it would have normally have done, because we were coming out of a massive credit crisis recession, a sovereign wealth crisis in Europe, a massive depression environment in Europe as a result of the very real contradictions that went into the creation of the euro. And then those feeding through to the bust of the commodity boom. That, of course, then all contributed to demand for exports slowing in China and the need for even greater monetary stimulus there. So we did move into a period of time where we've had synchronized global monetary expansion. And that is now potentially ending. And I think that is perhaps the best way to think about it. There are, of course, some people that say that people really started to understand that quantitative easing had come to its logical conclusion when we had negative real interest rates. It's not negative real interest rates, it's negative deposit rates, negative interest rates. And we can see that the German 10-year traded in negative territory for about 4 months this year. And we can see it there going below zero in July of this year and coming back above zero in October. And having a negative yield on a bond is ludicrous. It is literally paying the government to take your money. And of course, it wasn't simply governments. It wasn't simply the German government. It was a number of governments. It was, you have a situation where even today that Italy can borrow at better rates than the US government. And that is simply ridiculous. It is a situation that is frankly impossible without the very clear aid of the ECB. But the potential for fiscal stimulus, and fiscal stimulus isn't something that we have had in any great amount for well over a decade, and the fact that the USA is about to engage in it, and not just fiscal stimulus but deregulation. What we have had since the credit crisis has been a slew of additional regulations. There is certainly the tendency among policymakers to fight the last war. The conclusion that was reached after the credit crisis was that there simply were not enough of regulations, that free market economics does not work. And what was actually required was more regulations, when in fact what was probably required was for free market economics to have run its course and to have allowed the underwater creditors to go bust, the underwater debtors to go bust, and to allow stronger parties to come in and pick up assets. At least there should have been a much more widespread writing down of bad loans. If Europe had engaged in that, come to that conclusion, then they wouldn't be in the same kind of trouble today that they are. The US has certainly been able to, it did force the banks to take the write downs. It went through a massive foreclosure crisis overall, and that has resulted in the banks being de-risked. The banking sector is no longer the largest provider of mortgages in the US. It is primarily now either Fannie or Freddie, or it is private lenders overall. And that's a huge change. And it does suggest that on this occasion, the banking sector is not overly leveraged to the housing sector for the simple reason that they have not been lending, and not lending to nearly the same extent as some of the private lenders. They are in a much better position to benefit from deregulation, to benefit from higher interest rates and infrastructure spending overall. And that is something that's very different. When we look at Europe, then, the euro this week broke below 105. And there is really nothing magical about the 105 area. It simply represents the lower side of an almost 2-year range. When we look at it over the longer term, then there is nothing magical about 105. Certainly, even if we look at the lengthy long-term chart, there's nothing particularly magical about parity either. What we have seen is that there have been two occasions on which the euro and previously the Deutschmark traded below parity. One of those was in 1985 and also 1984, or at least the low was in 1985, and the other was right after the introduction of the euro. What we are now going to see is whether we're going to see another period of time where the euro trades weaker than the dollar. And that's likely to represent a crisis, an existential crisis for Europe. They really do have to decide what they're going to do. and it will require lengthy debate, lengthy decision making, perhaps new treaties to be drawn up, and a real vision for what a united Europe would look like. And of course, the problem is that there is scant evidence that there is any appetite for a united Europe at all. But we do know that bureaucrats are primarily and most particularly interested in ensuring they still have jobs, and therefore the likelihood of a fiscal stimulus is, I think, becoming increasingly likely. What we have certainly seen is this, just this week and the week before, in fact, as well, that there was the BRRD, which is the Banking Reconciliation, and I can't remember the rest of the acronym, but it is the European Directive that there would be no bailouts, which was implemented after the rather onerous solution was imposed on Cyprus, and they said that that was how everything was going to happen from now on. And what we have evidence now of is that there is certainly one set of rules for a small country and quite another set for a large country, because the Italian government is going to take almost a 2 billion euro position in Banca dei Monti Paschi di Siena. UniCredito is going for a massive capital raising, and if it can't source that money in the private sector, then the government can probably be relied on to put up even more money. And those are only two banks. Italy has got lots, and they are all going to have to fess up to the massive debts that they have overall. But of course, what that means is that what we now have clear evidence of is that there is the world of difference in Europe between policy and politics. And that is something that I've been saying, I think it must be years now. There is the world of difference between policy and politics, because the politics is such that it can change from day to day, but the policy is to ensure the sustainability of the euro. And we know that they want to sustain the euro, because there is no country benefits more from it than Germany. So, therefore, whatever is required to ensure the sustainability of the euro will be followed. The fact that Italy is going to be allowed to bail out BMPS is, in fact, good news from the stock market's perspective. It's terrible news from a governance perspective. It really does mean that, as far as governance goes, the EU is riding roughshod over its founding principles, because they simply will do whatever it takes rather than abiding by the rules that have been negotiated. What is very clear is that the rules are there for convenience. They're when time comes to negotiate, then they will negotiate based on the rules. But when it is convenient to ignore the rules, they simply do that. So that is really quite clear. But when we look at the euro stocks, the fact that the euro was breaking down this week means that the stock market is going up. And my Bloomberg is resetting here. And this is, of course, not the first time. We have seen exactly the same thing previously. We've seen it in Japan, where the Nikkei is on a tear over the last few months, that it has simply gone up in a straight line because the yen has been going down in a straight line. And I'm showing it here against the dollar, so it's the dollar rising against the yen. When we look at the second section index, the second section is the small cap index. It has been a reliable lead indicator for the Japanese market for really as long as we've been watching it, and it is now testing its high. Now, I think anybody can look at this chart and see very clearly that it is overbought in the short term. So there is certainly a possibility for some consolidation overall. But of course, because it has been enabled by the weakness of the yen relative to the dollar, then what happens to the dollar is going to have a major effect overall on what happens with Japan's equity markets. One of the things that we have certainly seen, and I think that it is no longer about the, and here's the chart of Bitcoin. I don't think that it is anything at all to do with cryptocurrency anymore. I don't think that it really gives us any idea of what exactly is going on when we think about the advances that are being made in blockchain technology, because a lot of the advances that are being driven at are an attempt to divorce blockchain from Bitcoin. But what exactly does Bitcoin allow people to do? It is highly effective at surmounting challenges imposed by governments to control the flow of capital across borders. And that is particularly the case for China. When we look at what is indeed happening with China, then there is certainly this, what we're definitely seeing is that it is the Chinese are most active in Bitcoin. And there is a website, and it's called flatleak.com, and it's the middle of the night in China right now, so you're not seeing anything flowing in terms of Bitcoin trades, but it is only 7 o'clock in the evening in the U.S. On the west coast of the U.S. and we can see that there is no Bitcoin activity right now. If we were looking at this in UK time or in Chinese time, then there is a steady flow of Bitcoin into China, and I would suggest looking at it at in that time zone, because there would appear to be very few other people who are buying Bitcoins other than the Chinese. And if that is indeed the case, then what does that tell us? It tells us that the Chinese are worried. And it isn't the Chinese government, it's Chinese people are worried about the fact that the renminbi is going down fast. Because they've been through this before. The renminbi has been getting weaker for over 2 years already, and we have ample evidence of how fast it can go down from periods of time in the 1980s. In fact, the entire appreciation from 2005 until about 2013 simply undid the one-day depreciation from 1994. And now we're back in a period of time where China needs a weaker currency. China is getting a weaker currency, and in fact, all they're trying to do is to stop the decline of the currency, and they're selling their treasuries in order to support the currency. They're selling dollars to buy renminbi in order to just try and cool down the decline in the renminbi. And that is now beginning to have an effect on the stock market. The stock market has pulled back somewhat. It is right in the region of the 200-day moving average. This is a relatively equal-sized reaction overall. If this ranging consolidation with an upward bias is going to continue, then the index will have to find support and find it relatively soon. The HSCEI is the H share index of large Chinese companies, and it's denominated in dollars. The fact that the dollar is going up so quickly is acting as a headwind right now. This is an equal size reaction relative to what we saw in the first half of this year. But it does need to hold the 9,000 level, and it is now right in the region of the 200-day moving average. If it's going to find support, then this really is the area. The thing, of course, that is worrying is what will the Chinese do with their treasury holdings? What we continue to see is that there is uncertainty about what is going to happen next with the incoming US administration being much likely to be much more assertive on the international front. And considering that China has pretty much had its own way, where in order there has been very much a pay-to-play policy in place with anyone who wanted to do business in China. There has been a necessity to share technology. And then what people have found is that their technology is used against them, and the factory down the road simply starts up and starts copycatting everything that has been done. So it is very hard to make money for foreign companies in China. And that hasn't stopped China then exporting a lot of very cheap goods overall and picking and choosing what foreign companies get to participate in its market. And the rather aggressive actions that it has been taking in the South China Sea, which have largely gone unopposed, are something else that really tells us that a country does not spend the second highest budget in the world on arms without having some view as to potentially using them in future. That is also a potential outcome. So little wonder that the Chinese population are looking at ways of moving some of their money offshore. And of course, that is also bad news for the renminbi, because they're selling renminbi in order to buy other currencies. And that is putting a downward drag on China's foreign reserves. $40 billion last month, and it was $40 billion or more the month before. Well, if you're selling upwards of a half hundred billion every month, then even if you have 1.4 trillion, then it can go down to 1.1 trillion in less than a year, which is exactly what has happened. Now, when we look at the effect that that's likely to have on the Chinese market, it's likely to be cushioned somewhat by the weakness of the currency. But what we're seeing in not just China, it's in many emerging markets, is that the strength of the dollar is acting as a headwind overall. And in comment of the day today, I've posted a number of charts for it's really the iShares or Global X country indices denominated in US dollars. Because when we look at the Indonesian market, we could really be forgiven for thinking that anything at all had happened, that the index has recently tested its all-time peak. It's still within striking distance of it. But that doesn't give us an indication of just how much the rupiah had fallen until that US dollar peak in late 2015. And the fact that it has now broken that progression of lower rally highs and the dollar is finding support in the region of the 200-day moving average, that's putting pressure on the ETF, which is denominated in dollars and has a very different trajectory overall. The progression of higher reaction lows has been broken. It is now trading below the 200-day moving average. That is a weekly key reversal in the region of the 200-day moving average just this week. So then when we look at that, we have to conclude that we are in a very different environment overall. And we can look at a number of other markets. If we look at Mexico, where the currency is still under pressure, then that is having a direct impact on the stock market. And we get a clear idea of just how much currency can have an effect. Most particularly, that is true of Brazil. The Brazilian market has soared this year. It has certainly been helped along by the currency, because the currency spent much of the year compressing against the dollar. The dollar spent much of the year compressing against the real. But the big question right now is whether that is over, because we had a substantial compression from over 4 to just over 3 reals, and that was a big rally by the dollar just after the election, and now it is finding support in the region of the 200-day moving average. That could suggest that the story of big rallies in emerging markets was this year's story, and that there is the potential that it is going to be quite a different story next year. It really is all down to what happens with the dollar. The dollar index broke out ahead of the euro breaking down this week. The Asia dollar index, which is heavily weighted by renminbi, is breaking down to new lows, and it really hasn't been this low in a fair amount of time. That it you have to go all the way back to 2009, and this is a very different situation overall, because back in 2009, the Asian currencies were collateral damage relative to what was happening in the U.S. and then in Europe. They weren't really overly affected by the credit crisis, and they bounced back very quickly. What I think people are now worried about is the extent to which there is dollar-denominated debt. That was certainly an issue last year, but it has not gone away. The ability of companies to refinance is impacted by the relative softness of their own economies and the relative strength of the dollar overall. But this is a clearly defined downtrend for the Asia dollar index. And the Latin American dollar index, which is very heavily weighted by real and Mexican pesos, that trended lower in a very consistent manner. You can see that it has not rallied to nearly the same extent as the Brazilian real. It has been much more affected, or at least it has been its rally has been tempered by the weakness of the peso. But it has not been able to sustain a move above the 200-day moving average. There has been a loss of momentum, but it absolutely needs to hold that 60 area. If it can't hold the 60 area, then this may have been simply a lengthier pause within an otherwise reasonably consistent downtrend. And best case scenario is that it is type 3 base formation, and that we move into a lengthy and volatile ranging phase. So when those factors are taken into consideration, and we have had substantial rallies in a number of commodity producing countries, then the question is whether that can continue with the strength of the dollar. And the continuous commodity index has been firmer. And part of the reason it has been firmer has been because of oil. It's an unweighted index, but oil and the energy contracts are, on aggregate, a reasonably large weighting. Oil prices have been pretty volatile this week, but so far it looks like a consolidation above the 6 month trading range, and really a sustained move below 50 would really be required to question that conclusion. When we look at the industrial metal complex, then copper has been late on the scene, and its explosive breakout has really been responsible for that big move that we've seen in the last while, but it is overbought in the short term. Now, this index has certainly broken the downtrend. So the question rather is, at what point will it find support? Will we get a somewhat lengthier consolidation before the overall bull trend is reasserted? And of course, the industrial metals and oil benefit from infrastructure spending and the potential for higher economic growth overall. It's a philosophical question, and it's something that I'm very much looking forward to meeting. I'm very much looking forward to meeting Alan Greenspan at the end of January. I've been invited to a private talk and sit down with him. And I don't know why that's not working. One second, let me pull up the longer chart. When I get to meet one of the former heads of the Federal Reserve, and most particularly when he was in power, it was in the 1990s. And that was when the velocity of money peaked. Velocity of money has been falling at an alarming rate. Now, part of the reason for that is because of the internet. The fact that the internet was really described in the 1990s and the early 2000s as a disintermediation. So it just simply cut out whole segments of the supply chain. In addition to that, it has simply done away with costs that we would have had to pay out for at a number of different locations. So today I use Waze, and that is provided by Google for free for as GPS, and I don't have to pay Garmin for that. I can download music from iTunes, so I don't need to go to a record store. I can read books on my Kindle. I don't need to go to a bookstore. And Amazon has just opened a supermarket in Seattle that doesn't have any tellers. That you simply use the app and you pay for goods as you walk out of the store. And these are huge changes. And if you are taking steps out of the number of steps that money takes before it circulates the system away, then the velocity of that money goes down. It simply goes from the originator of a product to the purchaser of a product, and there is no intermediaries between them. So there are fewer steps and velocity goes down. The fact that velocity of money accelerated lower after the credit crisis, of course, was not least because of the deflationary impact of the credit crisis. So that was an additional factor. Quantitative easing, by virtue of the fact that it was making capital available to people who already had a lot of capital, rather than those without capital, that led to asset prices rising, but not to transactions rising, and therefore velocity of money went down even further. If the internet was responsible for the original peak in velocity of money, perhaps automation is contributing to its continued decline, because robotics and artificial intelligence and the increasing penetration overall of logarithmic or algorithmic ways of thinking and programming are getting rid of many different additional services. So, what is it that can get the velocity of money to turn around, where we can get real substantive growth? Well, fiscal stimulus might well be the way to do it. That instead of lending money to the banks, you lend it to people. And you put money in people's hands, either through work or simply by giving it to them or making it available to them with low interest or long-dated loans. And then you ensure that inflation picks up to to diminish the value of the money in future. That could be enough to get economic activity moving once more. And it is likely to be different than anything that we've seen previously. The economy is constantly changing. There are new sectors evolving all the time. The very fact that you can now have Airbnb and you simply go to the landlord, they hire a cleaner and handle everything themselves, and you don't have to go to a hotel, and you consider how many people work in hotels. It is considerably more than, you know, there are a number of landlords, and I've used Airbnb previously, where they might have 20 or 30 properties, and they're managing everything themselves, and it is very easy to do. And they have a very small team of cleaners. There are none of the reception staff, there are none of the restaurant staff, there are none of the concierges or the bellhops or the porters, and that is another disruptive industry. So, you know, we are certainly living through a profound change in the global economy. There are clearly different ways that are going to have to be approached in order to try and break out of this funk, because if the velocity of money continues to go down, then central banks will have to continue to print it. They have very simple mandates. Now, they have taken on massive additional responsibilities, but their central mandate is that they have to ensure there is enough of money in the system to foster economic growth. It would really suggest that how they measure economic growth needs to be revisited, because it is not working. And I think that as people come to that conclusion, and there is solid argument, at least there is an argument that can be made that is indeed the case, then it isn't simply a populist reference that you need to have fiscal spending, but perhaps you will have academics rowing in behind it, that it is the way to get things done, that simply lending money to banks so that they can lodge that money with the Federal Reserve and pick up a carry is not how you get economic growth moving. I think everybody now accepts that. Negative real interest rates are negative yields are inherently deflationary. And that is something that I think people are finally coming around to. And therefore, the potential that we are going to move into a synchronized period of fiscal expansion is becoming increasingly pronounced. We are already starting to hear people in Silicon Valley talking about universal basic income. There are small towns in Newfoundland, I think Berkeley is also, I think it's Oakland, is also experimenting with it. Small communes in various parts of the world are experimenting with universal basic income. It is the antithesis of capitalism in how we tend to think of it. It is giving way to profound socialism. And there is a very big question as to how you can incentivize people to work if you are simply giving them money. That is a very, very large question. And indeed, where is that money going to come from if everyone doesn't want to work? And these are very, very large questions. But I think we're going to have to come up with an answer if we're going to have the prosperous economic future for everyone. Most particularly, it is there are big questions for Europe in particular, but also Japan, about how many old people there are and how much debt there is. Europe has got terrible demographics. Japan's are worse. China's are a looming problem. It's probably not going to be a major problem for at least a decade, perhaps even 2 decades, but it is a looming problem. Some of the only countries that have got really positive demographics are India and Vietnam. And the USA has got some of the best demographics in the developed world, and not least because it has got a large population pool in a large number of countries in south of its border. And that represents a massive pool of potential workers for future generations, regardless of how palatable that is or not for the current, or at least the incoming administration. When we then think about where we are in terms of the overall cycle, and I'm very conscious of the fact that I've been talking for 45 minutes and I haven't looked at stock markets at all. But when we look at the S&P 500, then, and that is only going up to 2006, so it doesn't look at all like what we would be assuming it would look like. Then we're presented with a market that went sideways for 13 years and has broken on the upside. This isn't the first time it's done it. It has done it on previous occasions. When we look at the ratio of the Dow Jones to gold, then most people tend to look at this as a confirmation of when you have big bull markets in precious metal. And we've had big bull markets in the precious metal. We had them in the early 1930s. We had a massive bull market from the 60s all the way through to the 1980s. And then we had a very big bull market from 1999 and all the way through to 2011. But even more important is that every time after we have a big bull market in precious metals, we have phenomenal bull markets in equities. We had a massive bull market in equities after the Depression in the 1930s and after the war in the 1940s through the mid-1960s. We had a phenomenal bull market from 1980 until 1999. And we have had a storming bull market from 2009 until presently. Now, there are very large questions as to what is going to be done about all the debt. Will fiscal stimulus simply increase the debt and not generate the kind of growth required to really start to get that debt mountain down? And of course, we know how governments have tended to act when they have large quantities of debt before, and they have tried to inflate it away. Their actions so far haven't been particularly effective. That does not mean that their actions in future will not be effective. The run-up in government bond yields that we have seen is representative of the market beginning to price in the return of inflation. If inflation starts to increase once more, then equity markets will also rise in nominal terms. Now, the purchasing power of the dollar would perhaps continue to decline, but that would simply push up the nominal price of just about everything else. This is a chart which suggests that we are in a new secular bull market for equities. And that suggests that gold prices will not do as well as equities over the long term. Gold prices have been pulling back very, very sharply over the last 6 weeks. In absolute terms, we are coming rapidly back towards a potential area of support. There is a clear short-term oversold condition. If we look at the very short-term stochastics, then they are both long and short-term stochastics are in really quite oversold territory overall. We will have evidence that a low of at least near-term significance has been found when this progression of lower rally highs, evident since early November, is broken. Until then, this remains a reasonably consistent decline overall. And of course, the equity market is unlikely to rise in a straight line. And that is despite the fact that it has been rising in a straight line for the last 6 weeks. And this has been a very powerful rally overall. We haven't really seen anything like it in quite some time. It is the first bullish surprise that we've seen in the last few years. And it is a bit overbought in the short term. We are currently seeing a number of very big round numbers being tested. The Dow Jones is hovering here just below the big 20,000 level. The Nasdaq 100 is hovering just below the big psychological 5,000 level, and also it is the region of the long-term peak. In fact, we're above the long-term peak. So this is a period of time where we're going to get a little bit, it is likely we're going to get a little bit of consolidation. The question is whether that is going to be to turn into a somewhat larger pullback before the inauguration or after. Certainly, we have had a big move already, and quite similar to the enthusiasm that the world greeted Obama's accession to the presidency with. In fact, people were so enthusiastic that he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize before he had even taken office. And we are seeing similar enthusiasm, though for different reasons, with Trump's victory, the fact that he is committed to trying to bring down corporate taxes, to impose deregulation, and to introduce a fiscal stimulus. So there are certainly things to be really quite enthused about, and of course, that is entirely dependent on the potential that he actually does them. And what we could see next year is that Wall Street is the market that continues to do well. That emerging markets, having done reasonably well this year, move into another period of underperformance. That the industrial metals are still really quite depressed, and that we could be in for a continued rally in the resources sector, and simply because it is coming off such very low levels. If that is indeed the case, then we could perhaps conclude that we are in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market, and that we are perhaps at the end, we're coming towards the end of the beginning of a major bull market overall. And that when we look at that Dow gold ratio, that we are in the foothills of what is likely to be a phenomenal bull market, and that the likely progression of which is going to be punctuated by a number of sharp pullbacks, which will be buying opportunities overall. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.